Hello and welcome to the Long Game Podcast. I'm your host Mehdi Yakoubi, and this is the Long Game Podcast. In each episode, we explore the ideas, technologies, and businesses that will help us overcome the challenges of our time. The episode features long-form conversations with tech industry leaders, scientists, entrepreneurs, and thinkers. Some guests will be well-known, others will be soon, but they all share a profound similarity. They have demonstrated unusual insight and see today's challenges with a unique lens. When I'm not recording podcasts, I'm building LifeTizer, a product to help people optimize their blood glucose levels for better health, improved energy levels, and optimized longevity. And I send a weekly email newsletter called The Long Game. I hope you enjoy the show. My guest today is Patrick Friedman, a political theorist and the general partner at Pronomos Capital, the world's first charter city VC fund. Patrick is on a mission to increase competition in government. In 2008, Patrick founded the Seasteading Institute with a mission to create sovereign ocean colonies and establish permanent autonomous ocean communities to enable experimentation and innovation with diverse social, political, and legal systems. We spend a lot of time talking about competitive governance and why we need it. We also talk about the impact of technology on government and why building new institutions should be our primary focus now. We finish the conversation talking about meditation and nutrition. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Patrick Friedman. So actually, I did a lot of research because I really enjoy your work. And what I discovered is that basically the two main topics that you're super interested in are progress and innovation on one side, and then charter cities on the other side. And I'm very curious about how you think these two concepts are related and what are your ideas about this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that progress and innovation are a much broader topic, and that charter cities are like a particular strategy or a plan for bringing progress and innovation to governance. And, you know, I come at this from a Silicon Valley software engineer perspective. I spent 10 years at Google. And when I look at our laws and institutions, what I see is code, you know, like, code that hasn't yet been like open sourced and like copied and standardized. And so I think that we can get a lot of progress and innovation from just bringing governance up to the same kinds of standards that we have for our software.
Yeah, totally. So how do you see, basically when we're trying to create new cities, how do you see the process to go from a new city to a new hub for innovation? Because we can see that some new cities are very successful, where some others lack the success that these big new cities have. So how do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is that that laws matter, that the source code for society matters, and that having kind of good laws and institutions and honest government is fertile ground for economic development. And it doesn't guarantee it, but it at least gives you a shot. And there are a lot of other ingredients that it takes to make a tech hub. But, you know, I mean, maybe you could think about it like if you're trying to make a new app and you want to like, you need to run servers, like, if you try to write the operating system for those servers yourself, like that's basically what we do in our society, where like every country has these different legal systems and these different courts. And so every business that's operating in these countries is like having to kind of solve problems for themselves or like operate in a non-standard, non-optimal environment. And it's kind of like if you, you know, didn't have Amazon EC3 or Google Cloud or whatever. And if you move to a world where there's really great, really standardized platforms where whatever server you want to make, there's like clear APIs and it's cheap and it's easy to deploy, that creates the possibility for you to make an app of value. Now, it doesn't guarantee it. It doesn't invent the app for you. it's the platform. And so I think about new cities kind of the same way. They're a platform for economic activity.
That's fascinating. But do you think that right now there is a framework, there is a definition of what's a great city and what's a great type of governance? Or is it still something that we need to find out?
I'd say it's kind of in between. No, there's not a definition. It's something that we're still figuring out. But, you know, there's a smell to it. We know what countries are well run. We know what countries did a good job at handling coronavirus. We know what countries are growing economically. And so, you know, we have at least a sense for what works, but it hasn't been standardized yet. And that's part of what's so exciting about it, right? Is that we're, you know, it's like operating systems before Linux. Like there's still the opportunity for somebody to go out there, some genius, and just be like, all right, here's a new way of doing things. I'm going to study everything that's gone before. I'm going to like hole up and I'm just going to like produce code. I'm going to produce information that can be shared, which is all that laws are. And I think we need a lot more of those people.
Exactly. So, you know, right now, if we talk in practice, so when people are creating a new city, I know that you value a lot the power of experiments, and that the fact that having a lot of small cities and new government will enable a lot of new experiment that will help us find what is actually the best way to be governed. So how do you think about this process of trying different things? Because right now, we might not know exactly what are all these little components that would make the ideal society.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's like the flip side of it being an exciting time where we're kind of trying to come up with these standards and come up with the operating system, is that like, there's no one in the world who knows exactly what that should be. And we've got a lot of clues. You can look through history. My dad's last book was on legal systems that are very different from ours, just surveying different countries and what their laws and rules were, you know, and focusing on ones that were as different from ours as possible so that there's the maximum amount of learning and diversity from them. Even if you took the best person in the world of this, maybe someone like Tom Bell, like we don't know for sure. And one reason for this is that the technological environment and what's possible for organizing a society in terms of communications technology, that really affects what the best rules and institutions are. And so it's something that's always changing. You know, there's this mirage that like philosophers have, thinking that like you can just look at the universe and look at human nature and derive the absolutely best political system. And I'm very much opposed to that. I think of it as much, much more like engineering. Like you can always make a better car. There's always new materials. There's always new batteries. There's always new motors. It's just a constant tinkering. And that's how I think about governance. And if you think about it that way, well, then of course we need to be trying out new things, because like we don't know what the best laws and we don't know what the best institutions are. And so we want to be developing kind of a core OS that can be used around the world. But, you know, part of that is going to be that different people are going to write different versions of the core modules, and we're going to try them out. And there's going to be some that just turn out to be like too ahead of their time, and some that turn out to be like really great, and some that don't work at all, and some that work in some places, but not in others. And governance is really, it's complex and important, and we have to be open to all those possibilities.
That is very interesting, because this is actually a problem that we have, because when you see, for example, a lot of countries right now have constitutions that were created hundreds of years ago. So there's really this idea of how can we keep this OS that was created two or three centuries ago. It will obviously not be made for the new technological challenges that we have right now. So it's really about creating a system that enables future changes, because we cannot right now understand the challenge that we're going to have in a few decades, let alone in a few centuries. So how do you think about creating a system that will enable future change while still being true to some values?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we're kind of like, now we're getting into a bit more of the advanced topics. And I just want to say, I think that there's a lot of mileage that we can get from kind of the more basic approaches. I think that a lot of the constitutions of a lot of countries are pretty old. but there's really not an essential conflict between the idea of upgrading these operating systems and upgrading the rules and institutions and these old constitutions. I mean, for me, I know the United States the best, and there are certainly limits that the U.S. Constitution places on what kinds of like laws and institutions you could create, but they're not really problematic limits. Like, I think that we could redesign the United States government to run much, much, much better using the same constitution. You know, you can think of the constitution almost like the white paper or the goals, or like you were saying, the rules for change. And, you know, within that, there are just so many different ways of implementing it. There's so many different processes and structures that you can set up in order to try to achieve those goals. And some of them work much, much better or much, much worse than others. So, you know, I don't really see constitutions as a barrier, but I agree that being able to change and adapt as the world changes and as technology changes is really important. And that, you know, you touched on a key point, which is kind of separating out the values from the implementation. And I think that's really important. I think being, you know, like with a business, you have your strategy in mind, but then you're open-minded about exactly what features to make, about exactly what product to make. And I think that's really important.
So yeah, let's dig a little bit into this topic, because, you know, when we think about finding the ideal way of governing people, how do you think about culture? Because obviously, some people might say that the ideal way to govern a given culture will not necessarily be the same as a different culture that has different values. How do you think about that? And do you think that is possible to find something that can suit most humans on this planet?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is one of these advanced topics where I absolutely think that culture matters, and that the exactly right laws and institutions for each country are going to be different. Certainly the values for each country are going to be different, and they should be. I mean, I love like true diversity in governance where different countries actually have different goals and make different trade-offs. And I think that that's wonderful for humanity. And, you know, I just think that we shouldn't get, it's really easy to kind of use that as like, oh, we shouldn't develop this common operating system for our businesses or for our governments. We shouldn't build an open source library of, you know, institutions, because every country is different and every culture is different and what works here won't work there. I mean, sometimes it's true, you know. I mean, every server and piece of hardware is different, but like Linux runs on all of them, or at least most of them. You know, anything it's been customized for. And so I think that, you know, trying to preserve the differences in culture and have design laws and institutions that help to serve those different cultures, I think is really important. But it also shouldn't distract us from the idea that like, we're so early in this and there's so much standardization left to do. That's the phase that we're at. I think is standardization and kind of finding the commonalities and figuring out what works the best and making it available for everyone, for all countries, for all provinces, for all cities. And so, you know, let's preserve the culture, but let's also deploy kind of the standard technology so that every culture has the best tools available to them to create their type of society.
Yeah, totally. So let's go back to this idea of experimenting with the ways of governance, because for people that are outside of the field, it might be a little bit abstract of what type of thing we're going to try and what learnings we got from some of these experiments. So could you walk us through an experiment that happened in real life, whether it be a new city or a new country, where we learned that something works or doesn't work?
Sure. I mean, one of my favorite examples is Hong Kong and the way that it impacted China. You know, where they took this, the UK leased the land, and whether or not that was legitimate is that's a question for the past. but they implemented this simplified British common law based system that was business friendly. And, you know, there was this culture question, right? Like, can these rules and institutions that worked so well in the UK Commonwealth, like, will they work here on the other side of the world? And what we found is they did. And you know, maybe it was partly because of the location, because a trade hub was needed for Asia. But whatever the reason, clearly the people and the cultures were able to adapt really well to those rules and institutions and to economic freedom. And what we saw eventually over time is that after decades of economic growth in Hong Kong, when Deng Xiaoping was looking to reform China, he kind of took it as an example because it was nearby. And so he actually changed and reformed and experimented, you know, largely using special economic zones in mainland China, where he set up all these special economic zones that each had kind of like different laws and that were being used to test a reform of the entire Chinese economy. And, you know, the end result, you know, it's not the same, doesn't have the same economic freedom as in the West, but it has a lot more than it used to. And it was enough to enrich the whole country and bring more people out of poverty than the world has ever seen. So I think it's a powerful example.
Yeah, this is a powerful and beautiful example. And I want to explore a little bit the case of now the developing world and what's going to be the place of charter cities in these regions. For example, in Africa, do you think that charter cities can be a way to bring development much faster? For example, in a country having a city that has a very good operating system could promote the whole country to adopt these kinds of measures?
Yes, absolutely. And there's a lot of different reasons why the developing world, especially Africa, you know, are really interesting places. One is that in my work, I've just found that countries and regions that are struggling more, they're just much more open to change. If you look at the United States or Europe that has, you know, all of this great history and feels like, you know, they're the experts, they're really not open to change. They're not open to doing things in new ways. They're not open to adopting new technology. Whereas the countries around the world that say, hey, we want to leapfrog our development. We want to jump into the 21st century. Like, you know, we don't like what our level of economic development was in the 20th century, and we want to move past that. Those countries are just much more open-minded and much more interested in finding and adopting the best governance technology to help their people. So that's one powerful fact. The demographic trends in Africa are really important too, and urbanization. Africa's got the highest birth rate in the world. And as a result, not only is its population growing, but it's also urbanizing. And so in Africa, they're building new cities. They're building lots of new cities. They have to build new cities. They have no choice. And so, you know, why not, if you're doing this anyway, why not have these new cities that you build, you know, also be kind of potential upgrades to your society or experiments or new ways of doing things if you're building them anyway. So I think there's, you know, and there's also, this is sort of indefinable, but there's like a certain, I don't know, just like a certain energy to that continent where there's all of these different cultures. They've been held back for so long. And there's just all of this enthusiasm to like get organized and kind of make use of this like incredible untapped human potential there. So yeah, I'm very, very bullish on Africa. And one of our investments is in Nigeria.
Yeah, awesome. Well, for sure, Africa will benefit a lot from this approach. A lot of charter cities being built right now in Africa, and also some mega projects, like for example in Egypt, building a new capital for the country. So there's also this question: when some countries build new cities, sometimes it's not necessarily very very successful. Like for example. I don't know if we can really call it not successful, but a city like Brasilia is called by a lot of people like a city that doesn't really have the energy of life. So how do you think about creating really a a beautiful city where people are going to love living, even though it's a completely new city without any history. Do you have some examples in Africa or some new cities being recently built that are a huge success?
I mean, I would use Singapore as an example, and I agree with you. There's a lot of pitfalls that can happen. I mean, this gets at kind of the tension between, spontaneous order and design. And, you know, there's all kinds of philosophies that are on one side or the other. Brasilia was a product of postmodernism on the one side. And then you've got, you know, other philosophies, maybe Jane Jacobs or libertarianism, that kind of want to let things evolve and think that you shouldn't guide it. And, you know, kind of as everywhere else, as with everything else in life, I think neither of these kind of oversimplified or more extreme models are accurate. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. And if you don't guide your project enough, it's much more likely to fail. And at the same time, if you guide it too much, it's much more likely to fail. And so I think it's really important that that new cities kind of allow an economy to grow and develop that is broad and inclusive, and that they don't try to force a single type of economic activity, and that they kind of grow a sustainable economy, because that's what successful cities are. And, you know, this just, there's kind of, there's not a formula to it. It's just kind of a question. I mean, again, same thing with like a business and a product. I think one of the neat things about charter cities is it's this idea of like the city as the product. And if to make a good product, you have to make a good city that benefits and attracts a wide variety of citizens and businesses. And so it's really important. I think the earlier it is, the more guidance, you know, master planning, designing it. And Singapore is a really interesting example because it's a thriving, beautiful city with a rich, deep economy that was intensely guided. I think it kind of demonstrates like maybe the maximum amount of guidance that you can have and still turn out well. But it seems to have worked out really well for them. And, you know, maybe we want to guide less than they did. But you know, you can't just build it and hope that it'll work out. And this is something I worry about with some of the Middle Eastern city projects. In some cases, it seems like they're starting really big and kind of have, you know, they're imposing an order on it. And I just worry that that's not going to work out.
Yeah. So this idea of how to get order without imposing it is very fascinating. So the Alain Berthaud wrote about it in Order Without Design, and it's super interesting to see how some regulations really don't make any sense and create huge problems in the city, when actually the regulations aren't improved over time, can really end up to a city that isn't functioning well. So how do you think about keeping improving the operating system? Because it's very hard, as you just mentioned, to have it all figured out in the beginning. So you obviously need to decide something and then maybe change it along the way. So how do you think that this process has to be implemented?
Well, again, I'm a software guy. And so the idea of making a large, complex system of interacting standards and components that you're constantly upgrading, that's just what we live and breathe. And so I know that it can be done. Now, you know, there's obviously a lot of challenges when what you're upgrading is laws and institutions. You need to be much more careful, and, you know, people want to be familiar with it. But I think a lot of the same principles apply, right? Like, for example, in software, we have this idea of an API, which is, okay, here's, you know, you want to store info in a database, and that info could be blog posts or podcasts or web, you know, like your web traffic stats or whatever. We don't care. And we offer a certain standardized set of ways to store information, to search for information, and to load it. And if the people behind the scenes say, you know what, there's been a new discovery of a different algorithm and we're just going to like rewrite this entire thing so it works in a totally different way. You can do that and it's fine because as long as you're still fulfilling the same API, it doesn't create any problems for your users. So having modules where things are implemented in a variety of separate ways and you can kind of mix and match, having APIs and kind of boundaries between things, I think all of those principles could be used to make a legal system that was much, much easier to upgrade. You know, in the US, in a lot of countries, for example, the court system is there to judge facts and settle disputes and interpret the law. And that's kind of a module, right? That's a component. They're not writing the laws. They're not going out and arresting people or putting them in jail. They have this single job, which is like cases come to them and they listen to the cases and try to understand the facts and interpret the laws. Or you've got your legislative bodies, or you've got your police, or you've got your army. And I think that just the more that we can think of our laws and institutions as the operating system for a society, try to separate them into kind of distinct components, and then implement them as best we can and have mechanisms where you can swap out an implementation, you know, I think that's the way to go.
I know that you're fascinated by laws and different kind of laws that there are in different countries. And so what would be, for example, an example of a different system that a different law system that would work completely different than the system there is in the United States? For example, from the book of your father, as you just mentioned, he wrote about all of the different legal systems in the world, where we can really understand that the way we do things isn't necessarily the way that every other country does it. And maybe we can learn from what they do, because on some point, maybe that they do it in a better way.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm always a little bit reluctant to give specific systems, because the point of these ideas is that we need to be trying out new systems, and that's kind of the greatest leverage point. It's not that we have any shortage of ideas for how to like make these operating systems. What we have a shortage of is ways to put them in practice. And that's where charter cities kind of come in by saying, okay, you know, you don't want to replace your whole form of government. And that makes a lot of sense, but you also can't just keep doing things the old way forever. Like, it doesn't work. So what if you take an empty area and we say, all right, let's do things differently in this empty area. And the host country where that area is located, they still retain sovereignty. They monitor it. You know, they still have the army. They're still in many cases kind of the court of appeals. But they're letting different things happen there. I'll give you a couple examples of two kind of very, very different systems that could be tried, or maybe a few of them. So one would be something much more like direct democracy, where there's debates over how well the direct democracy, vote having citizens vote regularly on a lot more issues. There's a lot of debates about how well that would work. But I think a lot of the barriers to trying it are technological, that in order to have citizens kind of voting constantly and regularly, you need to have technology that makes that really easy, that makes it as easy to vote on an issue as to check your Facebook feed. And we're at the point now where we either have that or could have it really soon. Like, we could build that system so that our representatives, you know, instead of like voting for them every few years, and then they go off and do those things, where our representatives are more like kind of our delegates, where they're constantly getting input from their constituents and constantly hearing what the people want. And then their job is to try to go out and make it happen. So that would be one, would be kind of a direct democracy using internet technology. Another kind of very different system would take, say, Apple and the iPhone as a model, and that would be like a corporate city, the idea of a city as a product where a for-profit company says, okay, we're gonna try to build a city, and the incentive structure is going to be set up so that the more people who move here and the more prosperous they are, the more money that we make. And we're going to try to design the entire city to fit together into a beautiful user experience that people will love and that will make it easy for them to live good lives. And, you know, I think some people get worried about that, about whether they'll be, you know, giving too much power to that corporation. And here what's essential is the ability to exit. That, you know, I don't feel like I'm kind of, you know, I don't feel like Apple is like controlling my life, because I can always just stop using them. I have a lot of other options. And so I think that as long as people are free to kind of leave these cities that are products, I think it's very safe. Another system that my friend Robin Hanson proposes, which gets back to what you were saying earlier about separating values from implementation, and, you know, also relates to this software attitude, is what he calls futarchy. And the idea is that the citizens kind of choose what the values are, what direction society is trying to go, but then in deciding how to do it, you basically have these kind of like betting markets that are like stock markets, where people say, oh, well, we've all decided that we want to have less police violence or have more economic equality. Here's a proposal for how we might do that. And then people, like professional investors, will kind of bet on like what will work, which of these policies will get us what we want. And then you just go with whatever people have bet is the highest chance of working, and then you find out what happens. So those are three very different options: the direct democracy, the city as corporate product, and futarchy, that just shows a kind of a sketch of how big the space is of possible designs. I think we're using a tiny, tiny amount of like the set of possible laws and institutions. And that in the coming decades, it's just a really, really exciting time where there's just lots of other ways of doing things. And, you know, one thing, you know, I know there's a lot of debate about cryptocurrency and the degree to which it's going to like reform our economies and become a meaningful technology in practice. But from the governance and the experimentation perspective, I have no doubt that cryptocurrency is like the central place right now where people are trying out new laws and institutions and actually have hundreds of billions of dollars on the line. And so I think it's going to produce a lot of really, really interesting options and be a testing ground. And, you know, quadratic voting, for example, for public goods is one example of this, which is being tested with Git grants and Ethereum.
Yeah, so actually this is a great, these are all great examples. And in the case of crypto, what's truly fascinating is that it's both a way to get a new governance system and also a very strong community. So we can really feel that it could really become a new kind of a new state, a crypto state. Could you talk more a little bit about how do you see it going in terms of crypto in the coming years?
Sure. I mean, I think that it's possible for a new technology to have a huge impact, and yet for that impact to be really different than what we expect, or still to be smaller. When I think about the internet, you know, I started using the internet in the early 90s, and, you know, the degree to which it's in every part of our life right now, you know, it's just unbelievable. And you think about the .com and like the promise of .coms and the fact that people invested all this money and then it crashed, like, the actual impact that the internet has had in our lives is actually much bigger than what like the craziest sounding people during the .com era said. So I think we have clear evidence that technology can affect us deeply. And, you know, what the internet is a communication technology, and communication, you know, we're a society of independent beings who are all coordinating and working together. And so communication is incredibly important. But what crypto focuses on is economic activity, and economic activity is even broader. Like I have a joke that, you know, every the possible scope for crypto is all of our economic activity, which is by definition 100% of the economy. So that's pretty big. That's a pretty big percentage of the economy. But in terms of how it will go, I think we're still at a very early stage where there's some clear use cases like DeFi or Bitcoin as a store of value. And people have all kinds of ideas about how else to use this technology. Personally, I see it. I have this idea of crypto as markets eating the world, that it's this set of technologies for shared transactions, these APIs for economic coordination. And it's not the first use case happened to be this shared ledger of value, Bitcoin. But I think that people like keep trying to reproduce that and make tokens and make the tokens worth money. And that really, that's just like a very narrow version of the idea. And what cryptocurrency technology is a whole set of tools and protocols and ways of thinking for how to coordinate economic activity around the world without a central gatekeeper in ways that benefit all the participants. And I think that's really profound, but who knows, like, how many types of economic activity will be better done in that new way? I mean, there are disadvantages to decentralization. I mean, just the fact that on kind of current blockchains that don't scale that well, you have to, you have to like replicate any transaction on like all of the computers in the network. And, you know, they're working on more advanced technologies where that's not true, but it's true right now. So it's this very, very safe, very, very public, but very, very slow database. And there's going to be some things that's better for, like recording, you know, the global, like savings of value in Bitcoin. But there's a lot of other things, you know, is it going to be better for flight searches or cargo logistics? I'm not so sure. I think it will be for some of those. And it's just, we're very, very early in crypto right now. And it really remains to be seen kind of what the use is. I mean, it's a very general technology, but we still need to figure out how to use it in ways that make our economic activity like less frictionless and better. And, you know, we're seeing some of that now, again, with like DeFi or with cross-border payments, remittances. You know, there's some clear wins, or things like a global market for compute or for storage. So there's, you know, there's some clear progress, but it's early days yet.
Yeah, fascinating times. There's one thing that kept coming in what you're saying, this metaphor with software and especially technology. And I want to explore a little bit the relationship right now between new cities and new technology. Because when we look at the 20th century, geography was super important, especially in cities like Hong Kong, Singapore. Like, the geography is a very important part of it. Do you think that geography is going to remain as important as that? And so what's going to be the game-changing effect of technology when it comes to new city?
Yeah, I mean, clearly geography is getting less important, but that's, you know, kind of happening on a scale of decades or centuries. I mean, we see with COVID, there's been this kind of one-time jump in the amount of remote work. And this is a really, really powerful thing for competitive governance, because the more mobile citizens are, then the more that jurisdictions need to compete with them. And so it's this mobility and the ability of people to choose where they want to live based on what city is the best product for them, I think is really, really important. And I'm optimistic that it'll drive a lot of positive change in the next couple of decades. But geography still matters. And if you look at these historical examples of what we see as the most successful charter cities like Singapore or Hong Kong, they had great geography. And so there's something kind of ironic where, okay, people are more free to move. But if you're more free to move, that means that instead of staying wherever you happen to grow up, wherever you happen to be stuck, you can go to the best location in the world for what you're doing. Like, it's not so clear to me that this mobility means that people will just, you know, start new cities or just spread out all over the world, right? I, I think that we'll hopefully see a lot of specialization and people being able to kind of sort themselves based on what kind of job they have, what kind of people they want to be around, what their values are, and sort themselves into different cities. But you know, we're at the very beginning of that.
I wanted to explore with you a tweet of Balaji Srinivasan, who is an advisor to your fund Pronomos, if it's still the case. So he talked about the cloud city, basically, like creating cities in the cloud and in VR, and then materialize the city into the real world. So what do you think about this new concept?
Yeah, I mean, I think the cloud city is really interesting. And again, it's early days, and we don't really know how things are going to pan out. I mean, clearly, we've seen for decades now that the internet is this incredible tool for organizing communities. There are all of these really strong communities, and whether it's focused on, you know, entertainment like a game or a TV show, whether it's a self-help community on Reddit, like Stream Entry, you know, or the Peptides community, just people who are coordinating around like a single health focus, you know, and we were also seeing political tribes form where on the internet, because you can find the people who are like-minded all over the world, you're able to form a community with people who have much more similar values to you than just trying to coordinate with people across a broad geographic area. So there's clearly some of these big long-term secular trends that are making cloud communities much more viable. And you know, the question is, like physical presence still matters. It still matters how you get along in person. It still matters whether you can have lunch. And it's kind of not clear like what direction things are going to go, or you know, rather what the mix is going to be. Will these cloud communities be something where you've got your physical community, you've got like your local jurisdiction, and then you've got, you know, whether it's you're working in the cloud, your friends are in the cloud, your hobbies, your politics, but it stays mostly in the cloud and it kind of supplements your existing life? Will it go that way? Or will it be that people forming these cloud communities end up being really hungry to live together, and that, you know, in an era of where remote work is available to a much larger number of people, will these kind of cloud communities start to coalesce into physical communities where people go and live together? And whether that's, you know, something small, like I started a community in Mountain View that was 8 apartments, or whether it's something, you know, as big as a city or a city state, but we really don't know. But what's clear is that people are going to continue finding each other and organizing and interacting in the cloud. And we're just going to have to see how that affects their kind of physical world.
It's really interesting because it relates to the question of the impact of technology on our lives, and especially on screen time and how we relate to technology. Right now, with the current pandemic, screen time increased a lot globally. We can really ask ourselves, is it going to be a point where we're going to say, enough, I want more real life, or more and more people are going to get used to just having their whole life on screens? What do you think about that? And do you think that we're going to take the path of saying enough a little bit to technology and put some limits, or it's just going to increase and increase and increase? Right now, I think it's almost reaching the limits of awake time. Basically, in Brazil, I think they spend on average 10 hours in front of screens per day. And it's increasing a lot. So what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I think that as our communications technology gets better and better, that there's more and more things you can do. It's easier and easier to find your friends. And so it's natural that people will use them more. I mean, I think I'm not saying it's not dangerous. I have a lot of concerns, you know, when I see kind of like kids who are growing up online playing games, there's a sense I have that like those worlds are kind of real to them. maybe like as real as the real world. And I think that that's just, that's a strategic mistake. And it's just factually not true. Like the real world is our substrate. And if you get points in a game, kind of you, nothing has really happened. Whereas if you toil in the real world, if you sweat and if you make things, we all have more. If the game disappears, life goes on. You know, if the world disappears, the game is gone too. And so I do think there's a lot of risk to us turning more and more to these screens and to these artificial worlds. But I do think it's really natural when there's just more and more things you can do there, when your entertainment is there, your friends are there, that's where your community and like-minded people are. That's where you get advice about your health problems. That's where you go learn the latest meditation techniques and read the latest studies and kind of keep your pulse on what's happening in the world through podcasts. Like the more that is doable in the virtual world, just the more time we're going to spend there. And I think that's just, you know, there's no other way to do it. But, you know, personally, I think it's really important that we just kind of all keep an understanding of what's real and what's not. And, you know, I'm not saying that nothing online is real. I mean, you know, quite to the contrary, if we were talking about cryptocurrency and about the global store of value, that's something, you know, virtual that in a sense is real. It determines who can buy what in the real world. And, you know, information about people is kind of real. Photos is kind of real. Books are kind of real. Like, it's not that the virtual world isn't real. I mean, you could say math is the same way. Like, math is this beautiful abstract world where you can prove that things are absolutely true. It has its own reality independent of our reality, and it has a profound reality, you know, and at the same time, it's, you know, solving a math theorem doesn't get you food, doesn't get you fit, doesn't, you know, maybe it cures cancer, but it doesn't move you forward in your own life. And so just kind of understanding what's real and what's not, what parts of the virtual world are real, and just really, really valuing the substrate. I mean, the same way that I think a lot of people find in their personal development, a lot of smart people kind of ignore their bodies for a long time. They don't stay in shape. They don't eat right because what they're excited about is words and ideas. And eventually you hit your limits and you realize like, hey man, I run on this meat computer. Like, I am this meat robot, whether I like it or not, find it boring or not, like that's my substrate. And if I don't take care of it, I will suffer. And I think we need to look at the real world the same way.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's getting harder and harder. Actually, the line between the what's behind the screen and reality is getting very blurry. So people, and especially young people, they really, some of them and more of them struggle to kind of act in real life and make friends in real life. There are a lot of studies showing that we have more and more people that are struggling in terms of socially making friends in real life. So we can only think that it's going to get worse if we don't do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we're having, you know, that's why we're having these conversations, is to spread these ideas and help people understand like what are the critical factors in humanity advancing in the next decades, and how can we get on the same page and do something about it?
Yeah, so there are two things actually that you mentioned that I really want to understand a little bit more about you. These are nutrition and meditation. So could you walk me through a little bit how you think about those two things?
Sure. I mean, I'd say, you know, we've got a little bit of a theme here about not oversimplifying and understanding that there's a middle path. And, you know, for me, when I was younger, I got really into like the keto diets and Atkins diets in the 2000s and then paleo. And I do think that the kind of the paleo heuristic, which is the longer that humans have been eating something, the more likely it is we're adapted to it and it's good for us. The less processed it is, the better it probably is for us. I think it's a really good heuristic. You know, at the same time, it's not perfect. I think what paleo misses is that we are quite adapted to grains. And if you look at a lot of the diseases of Western civilization, like, you know, diabetes or Alzheimer's or tooth decay or even acne that people worry about, these, they're not so much things that have happened throughout the agricultural age. They're much more recent. It's more like the past century. And so blaming agriculture on it kind of doesn't make sense. I have to really appreciate agriculture, because even if it is like a dirtier fuel source than hunting and gathering, like, it scales. And because it scales, like, we were able to grow human population massively, and that's what's given us the ability to accumulate knowledge and technology and build a complex world where, you know, you and I are talking to each other across the oceans and making this podcast. So I think agriculture is really important. And I think that the paleo heuristic of assuming that, you know, all new things, all grains are bad is just not accurate. And, you know, what I'm seeing is that what's more important is things like what kinds of oils you eat, what kinds of grains you eat. I think there's a big difference between eating rice or potatoes, which seem to be clean burning grains that kind of aren't bad for us, you know, versus wheat, for example, which some people can tolerate well, but which a lot of people can't. And the paleo heuristic, you know, the old paleo, I mean, it's been revised because a lot of new data has come in, you know, which just kind of says, don't eat any grains, just eat like meat and vegetables and fruit. You know, I think it's not accurate. And it's really important to differentiate between, you know, I mean, vegetables. There's a big difference between making a vegetable soup like my lovely wife did this week and just pouring like soybean oil and just like cooking with massive amounts of like vegetable oils and seed oils. Like, those are totally different things. One of them, like, vegetables is this whole food that's natural that contains a lot of nutrients versus the like extracted kind of oil, which has various bad health properties. So that's a lot of how I think about diet, is just kind of trying to combine the paleo heuristic with the more modern research on what foods from the agricultural era are kind of beneficial versus harmful. And I know for me personally, I've got some genes related to lipid transport that mean that I have to watch my saturated fat. And I spent a lot of years, you know, kind of, again, in that Atkins world, seeing people who just ignored saturated fat and ate a really low carb, high fat diet and had great blood numbers. And I think that can work for a lot of people, but I've had to face in the last few years, like, you know, that's actually not me. Like, my body wants like omega-3s and olive oil, you know, and some amount of saturated fat is fine, but, you know, it negatively affects my blood lipid levels. So I think that kind of personalized exploration is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's actually what I'm working on, actually. But yeah, this approach is really the only approach that can work, is a personalized approach where people try and find what works for them. Because as you mentioned, it really depends on your body and how it will react to what you give it.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as meditation, I've been getting really into it this year, and it's just an incredibly powerful set of techniques. I mean, I think it really is fair to say that it's sort of like exercise for the mind. But like exercise, like, there are so many different ways that you can move your body, and any of them will get you some health benefits. But depending on exactly what you want, how your body works, what's fun for you, the right exercises are going to be different. And meditation, it's weird. I find it very intimidating because there's so many different options and I like want to do the right thing. And at the same time, just like, if you just get up and go take a walk, your body will benefit. It will be in better shape than if you sat around worrying about like what is the best way to exercise. And the same way, if you just start following your breath or looking at a candle or just keeping your awareness in the present moment, like, that's good for your brain. And that will kind of train you towards a better state. And if you get into it, there's just infinite customization. You can find all of these different techniques that have slightly different effects and that are specific for how you want to train your brain. I think, you know, one thing that I see in the meditation world is a lot of focus on insight, the idea that you realize things or have discoveries and that's what changes you. And that may be true to some degree, but for me, like the experiences I've had and the research I'm doing, I see it as much more like biofeedback or neurofeedback, where what you're doing is, you know, you have this brain that's firing, you know, and all of these different patterns and networks, and you're trying to train it into a different mode, a different, and not a completely different mode, but a different like spectrum of frequencies. And so I think just a lot of like repetition and patience and understanding that like you're doing this really slow process of just again and again getting your brain to operate in this different way, and that it's like the repeated application of that which produces the changes.
That's beautiful. For people that want to get started and start to meditate, what would you recommend? Do you have some book that helps you a lot in your practice?
Yeah, I think the best single system is called The Mind Illuminated by Kuladasa. And it's just, you know, it's not that it covers everything, you know, and it's not that it makes it totally easy. You still have to do the work. But in terms of just a single system that outlines the pitfalls, that gives you stages of progress, that tells you what to watch out for, gives you terminology and tells you what to do, it's the best system. And I think we could come up with things that are faster than the Mind Illuminated. I don't think it's like it's quite optimized, but it's the closest thing we have to like a single manual that will kind of, that will get you down that path. I also encourage people to check out the Reddit stream entry, all one word, which is the Reddit dedicated to meditation. There's also one called Meditation, but I think it's not as good. And the stream entry facts have a lot of really good information. And, you know, I think it's just really powerful. We're talking about cloud communities. I think it's just really powerful to be part of a group of people around the world who have this same interest and are training their minds in the same ways.
That's beautiful. Any other book recommendation that you really enjoyed recently?
If you want a crazy encyclopedia of meditation, there's a book called Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. It's free online, and it's just insane. It's just really, really long. It's by somebody who is just an incredibly practiced expert. You can think of it like reading a book by like a multiple sport Olympic athlete who just sits there talking about everything they've learned about how the body works in their entire life, except that it's about meditation and the brain. And there's something about this book where it's incredibly practical. Like we get all wrapped up. You hear a word like enlightenment, or you think of meditation as spiritual. And I'm not saying that it's not, but it brings up all of these other things for us where they're like, oh, if enlightenment, that sounds like being a higher being. And that means if I train in this thing, I'm not going to like do things that are wrong, and I'm not going to hurt people's feelings, or I'm never going to feel bad, or I'm never going to be cranky. Just all this kind of garbage that's just like not actually true. And one reason we meditate is that, yeah, it does make you less cranky. It does help you to be more calm and tranquil, but you know, you're adjusting a system. It's not like a kind of a night and day effect. And you can just really get the feeling from this Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha by Daniel Ingram that, you know, here's somebody who's incredibly skilled, who's put many thousands of hours into this, and he's gotten great benefits, and he's happy to talk about what those benefits are. But he's very against false advertising. And I think maybe because it's connected to religion and to Buddhism, or maybe because it's connected to personal growth and selling people the dream of, you know, having their brains work better and being happier. But for whatever reason, the meditation world, even though it is a powerful technique, I think everyone should exercise, everyone should meditate, everyone should work on getting good sleep. And that's just like the basics. It's incredibly powerful. But yet, even though it's incredibly powerful, there's just so much BS around it. There's so many overstated claims. And that's just really sad. And so just seeing a top expert who's just like, I'm going to tell it how it is. These are the experiences that you have. These are the things that you feel. This is what is possible to accomplish in this kind of encyclopedic way. It's just a revelation in kind of how to think about meditation.
Mastering the core teachings of the Buddha. Well, I'll check it out. Honestly, you sold it to me. So because I truly believe that, especially for human health and well-being, improving that at scale will be as much about inventing new stuff as it will be about rediscovering ancient wisdom. And we have a lot to do in the second thing as well, like rediscovering all of the thing that all these masters understood centuries or even millennia ago will be very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot we can learn from modern science and modern techniques about how to do it. But the fact remains that as humans, we all suffer. Life can be really hard for everyone. And we have different problems today than we had 200 years ago, but we still have a lot of suffering. And here's this school of thought and research and practice that has spent thousands of years only focusing on these questions of like, what exercises can a human being do with their mind? What can they try to learn? How can they try to live to suffer less? And that's incredibly important. And we should be supplementing it with new knowledge, but we should also just be drawing from it and using it a lot more because that's important. And I feel like, yeah, we're so focused on technology and material progress, and those things are great. But why are they great? They're great because they help alleviate suffering. They're great because they help us to be happy, to connect with each other, to be warm, to have enough food. So let's not miss. Maybe this goes back to what I was saying about the virtual world and the substrate. Like, let's not miss the substrate. The substrate is, what is the experience of consciousness that human beings are having, and how much are they suffering, and are they happy? And that's what, that's what everything, I think, whether it's charter cities or what you eat or how you train your mind, I think that's what everything should be directed at supporting.
That is a beautiful way to end this conversation. Patry, thank you so much for taking the time to come on The Long Game.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey again, it's Mehdi. Before you leave, I want to tell you about what we're building at Lifetizer. When it comes to health, Lifetizer believes in prevention and optimization. There's no reason to guess what works for you anymore when you can read the messages your body tries to tell you. At Lifetizer, we help people optimize their blood glucose levels through nutrition and exercise to improve how you feel, how you sleep, to get better health and optimize your longevity. Check it out at lifetizer.io and sign up for early access to the private beta. That's all for today, friends, and thank you so much for listening.